whereas philosophy is certainly not self-expression. And philosophy, of course, is argument. And you can say, well, is the conclusion true or is the argument valid?
Welcome to Five Questions, the podcast where we don't ask if the conclusion's true or the argument valid, but what they say about you. I'm your host, Kiran Setia. In each episode, I ask a philosopher five questions about themselves. There are two ground rules. One is that follow-up questions are allowed. The other is that the question I'm about to ask doesn't count as one of the five. So could you introduce yourself, tell us a bit about who you are and what kind of philosophical work you do?
Thanks, Kiran. It's a real pleasure to be here. My name's Ian Phillips. I'm currently a Bloomberg Distinguished Professor of Philosophy and Brain Sciences at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. And before that, I spent most of my academic career in Oxford and in London at UCL. I'm primarily a philosopher of mind. I especially work right now on issues to do with perception and consciousness. And I've also worked a lot on our experience of time. And over the years, my interests have become, I guess, increasingly empirical, to the extent that now my appointment is 50% in the Department of Psychology and Brain Sciences at Hopkins.
Well, I want to ask a question about your topics of research. So the experience of time is empirically and scientifically and philosophically interesting. It's also a topic of frequent casual commentary in which people will observe to each other that something seemed like it took forever, or that the pandemic seems to have lasted many years, or as if it's only lasted a month and the time has just shot by. I mean, did you get interested in the experience of time from the sort of first-person experience of time? Was that something that gripped you, or was it that you were interested in the philosophy of mind and this seemed like a particularly intractable or challenging set of problems?
That's a great question. So my partner, when she first met my father, said, oh, I now understand why you're interested in this topic, because he's a real stickler for being on time. And so, you know, as a child, I was always told, you know, you must be there at exactly 9 a.m. to leave the house. So I think that's the deep background. But what really got me into it as an undergraduate was, I think, reading Dennett. So I was always interested in consciousness. And in Consciousness Explained, there's a lot about the ways in which our stream of consciousness unfolds in time. And so that was a kind of interest that first got me into the subject, I think.
Well, I can say for listeners who may be wondering, Ian was exactly on time for this recording. He was on the dot. So I guess punctuality is an aspect of temperament that we may be trespassing on the question about temperament here, because that's an aspect of your acquired temperament that connects with your philosophical work. So, well, why don't I just ask you the official question inspired by Iris Murdoch, who begins the podcast telling us that philosophy is not self-expression, but who also wrote, to do philosophy is to explore one's temperament, and yet at the same time to attempt to discover the truth. So does your temperament influence your philosophy? And if so, how?
Yeah, surely it does. But of course, it's super hard to know how to test a hypothesis that I could come up with about how. But thinking about this question, and so my temperament, the one thing that I kept coming back to was the fact I grew up in London. And whilst I've not lived there for years now, I still strongly identify as a Londoner. And I think London is kind of reflected in my temperament in a couple of ways. So first off, it's incredibly old and rich city, full of ghosts and stories. And especially as a teenager, I would just walk right across the city and turn down random lanes and alleys, just discovering some little bit of history that there may be, or a hidden courtyard. So I think of London as having given me this sense of curiosity, and kind of combined with that, a real sense of the layers of things and the history around us. And the other thing that I felt, especially as a teenager growing up in the kind of late 90s, and despite, you know, the lots of the problems that are there still, but it felt to me an incredibly open and diverse and exciting place, full of different communities and identities and, you know, people from all around the world, but all equally Londoners there, and a really culturally vibrant place with all this new art and theatre and music going on. So, I mean, maybe this is a kind of aspiration rather than a trait I can just claim, but I like to think of myself as a curious person, an open person, someone who kind of has this love for both old traditional things and new exciting things. And intellectually, I hope there are some traces of that in my work. So places where I manage to take seriously both traditional philosophical concerns, but also attempt to fit them together with newer ideas, especially scientific ideas.
I like this analogy with wandering around London and exploring. I mean, do you like the experience of feeling lost that it's easy to get in cities like London when you go off the parts of the map you think you understand?
Yeah, and I do like getting lost, although I probably like doing it in places where I feel safe getting lost. So there was something about London where I knew the city well enough to feel I could get lost, but then always manage to orient myself back or find a tube station, and then I'd know roughly where I was. So I'm not sure I'd like to get lost in absolutely the middle of nowhere where I had no way of knowing how to get home.
Well, this is going to be a stretch, but I mean, that feeling of getting lost is one that people associate with philosophy often, the sense that the questions, one doesn't know where to start, that it's hard to find firm ground to stand on. And I mean, one thing you do in your work in Philosophy of Mind is draw on empirical data, on empirical psychology, and the interpretation of experiments. I mean, do those play the role of tube stops in your exploring of the problems of philosophy?
Sometimes I think it's great to be interested in science because I can know some facts at the end of the day rather than just have kind of frustrated myself trying to figure out an argument which turns out not to work. But actually, so much of my experience of science is an experience of not really being sure how to interpret some data or really what one should say about this particular phenomenon, that I don't think of myself these days, at least, as having a sense of the science as the hard facts around which I need to figure out a philosophy or anything like that. So no, I really think of it's more like the experience of being in a junk shop and just finding all this amazing stuff, this data, but then trying to figure out what you're going to do with it all.
Well, for question two, I'm going to go away from science towards art and ask you, is there a work of art that you love in part for its philosophical depth?
So I really love poetry. It was almost, you know, one of my first loves before I ever discovered philosophy. And the poem I chose for this question is by the Irish poet Louis MacNeice. It's called Snow. And it's not long, so maybe I should just read it. But
yeah, read it. Yeah.
Okay, so it's this poem about what the kind of richness and complexity of the world. And I find it a kind of constant and thrilling reminder of that. And it's just sort of one of those poems that, at least for me, just whenever I read it, sets my nerves tingling and fills me with a kind of sudden emotion. Okay, so here goes. The room was suddenly rich, and the great bay window was spawning snow and pink roses against it, soundlessly collateral and incompatible. World is suddener than we fancy it. World is crazier and more of it than we think, incorrigibly plural. I peel and portion a tangerine and spit the pips and feel the drunkenness of things being various. And the fire flames with a bubbling sound, for world is more spiteful and gay than one supposes, on the tongue, on the eyes, on the ears, in the palms of one's hands. There is more than glass between the snow and the huge roses.
Wow, it is an amazing poem. And the first thing that leaps out at me is that world is a mass noun in the sort of language of the poem. But that's an observation based on having just heard it. I'm going to put you on the spot since you brought the poem up and ask you to say something about what philosophically you think might be going on in the poem and why you love it so much.
Yeah, I mean, so maybe the most obvious thing to say is it's clearly not a poem of desert landscapes. It's a poem that sort of celebrates a certain kind of pluralism and richness. And maybe like you said about, you know, mass nouns, you know, a kind of ontological pluralism. And so I love this phrase, the drunkenness of things being various. And there are all these kind of tensions and felt contradictions in that richness that the poem speaks to, which feel to me like, you know, the kind of impetus that for me, and I think for lots of people, is an impetus towards philosophy. And it's a kind of reminder as well, like we shouldn't let our imaginations be too limited when we think about things. And I guess it relates to the curiosity that I mentioned before in relation to, you know, tramping around London streets and peeling back the layers of things and liking that. So I do think a lot of what I like about doing philosophy and science too is that kind of, you know, feeling.
It seems right that it's not about desert landscapes, the sort of sparse bleakness, even though snow could conjure up a kind of bleak winter landscape, kind of something featureless. And in this poem, it really isn't. It's sort of in contrast to, I'm thinking, I can't remember the name of which Wallace Stevens poem I'm thinking of, but that where the image of snow and ice really is one of sort of bleak desolation. So that's what sort of one puzzle about this poem. The other is that there's this variety, but we're seeing it through a window. So I wonder if there's a kind of sense of being trapped inside, if there's a kind of problem of ideas kind of thing, kind of indirect realism anxiety in the poem, that we're not seeing it directly, but only through some kind of medium.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, it does recall that, you know, before I saw it through a glass darkly, and now
yes,
I'm face to face. And it definitely has this discussion of the sensory aspect of the richness, which is something really of interest to me. It's about on the tongue, on the eyes, on the ears, in one's hands. So it's both our experience of the world, maybe directly or indirectly, but also the world itself that's rich, and the distance between those two things, you know, the space between the glass and the snow and the roses at the end, very much, you know, as a philosopher of perception, something that is kind of inspiring.
So before we leave the subject of this poem and poetry in general, are there other Louis MacNeice poems that you really like? I he's not someone whose work I really know.
So it's a wonderful sort of long series called The Autumn Journal, which is written in, I guess, 1938, just sort of in the lead up to, well, maybe the beginning of 1939 too, so in the lead up to the Second World War. So he's very much writing this poem, I guess, in the years between the First and Second World Wars. And that poem is really and it's beautiful, but also kind of full of just the sense of impending, you know, horror and terror of what's about to come, and that he's writing just with this knowledge of it about to happen. So that's a very moving series.
Okay, I will look it up, and I will read it. That, I do really love this poem, Snow, and I'm grateful for reading it. I'm going to go back to philosophy and ask you a question about your relation over time to philosophy, which is fitting as someone who works on the philosophy of temporal experience. It's this: have you changed your mind about anything significant in philosophy, and if so, how?
Yeah, so a lot of my recent work has been concerned with the relationship between the mind and consciousness, and in particular whether perception can occur in the absence of consciousness. And almost to my own surprise, I've kind of ended up defending the pretty radical view that there's just no good evidence to believe in unconscious perception. And that's absolutely not something I've always thought. Indeed, pretty much every kind of case of putative unconscious perception, which I set out to criticize and show isn't actually a case of unconscious perception, is one that I can find some PowerPoint slide of me teaching to students showing, you know, saying this is a case where perception and consciousness come apart. So I've really changed my mind across the board on all those cases, I guess. And I think that just reflects back on that attitude towards science I was kind of talking about a little bit earlier. So when I first started getting interested in psychology more seriously, and this might reflect the fact that my undergraduate training was in physics, where really we were being taught things which are pretty much just facts from the early 20th century, I kind of thought, well, I'm going to go away and read a textbook or read some papers in top journals like Science or Nature, and they will just tell me what one should think, you know, what's known about the mind. And I really think that was super naive, and it's just not how one should approach psychology. You know, all the papers in top journals are there because they're, you know, striking controversial results, and almost the majority of them, I suspect, are really problematic in some way. And just those sciences, the sciences still, like psychological and cognitive sciences, just still in their adolescence. And so there's so much there to still figure out and establish about how we should think about the data, and so many confounds and problems. I also guess I thought of science as kind of somehow more unified and as making much more linear progress than I now appreciate that it does. There's just much more disagreements, the same kind of loss of ideas and reinvention that you find in philosophy. So I think I've changed my mind both about this particular set of issues, but also about, you know, what psychology is and how philosophers should engage with it.
Well, I'm torn in two directions here, both in the direction of the details and the direction of the big picture. So maybe I'll start with the details and then see where we go from there. If you had to pick one example in which scientists and philosophers have thought this is unconscious perception, and you're now convinced that it isn't, or at least that the data doesn't show that. What's an example that springs to mind?
So I guess the case I've worked most on, and I think has been most influential in philosophy and in science, is this case called blindsight. And so blindsight is a condition that's caused by damage, probably through a stroke, to this area right at the back of your head called V1 or primary visual cortex. And so if you have damage to this area, then the kind of characteristic presentation that you find in textbooks is that, as far as you're concerned, you go blind in some corresponding area of your visual field. So if you have damage on the left-hand side of your brain, then you go blind on the right. Seems to you like you can't see anything. And yet when the scientist, you know, moves the stimulus up and down or left to right in your right visual field, you are able to guess better than chance anyway, but sometimes like really a lot better than chance, like 95% accurate, whether it's going left or right or whether it's going up or down. So this has struck many people as showing that you can make these visual discriminations showing you really do see, and yet you say you can't see. So what better evidence that you're not conscious? And so that's a case which I think is not really a case of unconscious perception, but I used to think it was, and I think has convinced many that it's a real thing.
Is there a quick way to explain what the alternative reading of the data is that you now favor?
Yeah, I think that what's basically going on is that the kind of vision you have in your blind field, in big quotation marks, is extremely degraded and very, very different to kind of ordinary vision. So it's not a visual world of colors and objects and shapes. Really, you might have some sort of dim sense of the salience of things, in particular, maybe the changes are salient to you. But one blindsight patient calls his experience as one of like black on black. He offers another description where he says it's like if you're a sighted person, you close your eyes, look towards a bright light, and wave your hand in front of your closed eyes. So when a subject like that is being asked a question about whether they're aware of anything, whether they see anything, there's a kind of temptation to say, well, no, not really. It's nothing like, you know, seeing an object or seeing in my, you know, sighted field. But really there is, I think, residual conscious awareness there that's sufficient to do a certain range of tasks. And so if you kind of pick up on those specific tasks, they look like there's vision there. And there is vision, I think, of a certain kind. It's just based on this very degraded and very different, qualitatively different kind of experience, which the subject themselves is not reporting when they're given these did you see anything or not kind of questions. But you ask them more nuanced questions, and you do find reports of experience. So I think part of the complexity here is like thinking about what goes into making a report about your experience. And we shouldn't just take a yes, no answer to a simple question as clear evidence that there was or wasn't experience there.
So if you're right, there's sort of a central experiment that has been misinterpreted or misunderstood for a long period of time. And there's a way in which that should worry psychologists. And it should worry us a little bit about the idea that psychology is a sort of, as you said, you said it's in its adolescence. It should worry us about the idea that it's a sort of autonomous science functioning on its own. I mean, this is sort of the big picture thing I wanted to ask about is, how do you think, in light of these reinterpretations, about the relationship between philosophy and psychology and the kind of standard narrative on which psychology hived off and became a science in its own right in the 19th century, if here we are in the 21st century, still in a situation where philosophers reflecting, in which a philosopher is putting a kind of long-standing interpretation of data in the field into question?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to take too much credit for philosophy or indeed for myself, and nor say something too negative about the lack of autonomy in psychology. I mean, so a lot of the things that I've pointed out are things that are kind of there in the psychological literature. I may have assembled them and made some arguments more forcefully or something like that, but I don't see my contribution as distinctively one that, you know, was completely absent from the psychological literature at all. And it's also, a lot of my work draws on these frameworks, which were developed really in the 50s and 60s by psychologists, and I think have not been taken seriously enough, not by the field as a whole, I should say. I mean, some people take them very, very seriously. So I think there is definitely scope for philosophical work, but I think there are a huge number of really good, serious frameworks within psychology. It's just a field which, you know, doesn't have quite its Darwin or its periodic table or its, you know, one kind of common framework that the whole field is structured around yet. So maybe a part of what I mean by adolescence is that there isn't that common reference point for everyone.
Well, maybe at this point we'll descend from the heights of speculation about the nature of psychology to the more frivolous question. Question four: could you tell us about a hobby or something you love that you're embarrassed to admit?
Yes. Yeah, so my answer to this question is chess, and in itself, that's not very embarrassing at all, I don't think. But I mean, the reason I chose it is just because I'm terrible at it, and, you know, I never played seriously as a kid. Indeed, it turns out I didn't even know the rules properly when I sort of took it up about a year ago. And I started out thinking a bit like, well, I'm a smart person. My job is about careful logical thinking. So surely I'm going to be a pretty decent player in not too long. And that turned out to be a million miles from the truth. It's just amazing to me how hard the game is. But of course, there are lots of philosophers and other academics who are extremely good players. And I've definitely mentioned that I'm interested in chess at conferences and then ended up getting completely thrashed in a quick game in the hotel lobby. Indeed, I'm pretty sure there are listeners here who've got 8-year-old daughters and sons who could crush me in a game. But nonetheless, I love it. So I sort of embarrass myself by bringing this up and then that happens.
I find this very interesting. I mean, are you someone who in general finds liking to float free of whether you're good at things? Or is chess partly attractive to you because it's the unusual case where you like something even though you acknowledge that you're not good at it?
I don't mind being bad at things, but I like to get better at things. I think the experience of improving is really enjoyable for me. So I think the interest in chess was really just this whole interesting world opened up when I realized how complicated and rich it was, going back to things I've said before. And so that was, I think, the impetus to getting into it. And maybe I've got enough of a sense of self and self-confidence not to really care too much about my risible chess rating. And I can just enjoy it and improving for its own sake.
But do you have a chess rating? Is this a way you can track whether you're getting better?
Yeah, you can. I mean, you can, you know, on various websites, you can be rated on something like a common scale. So I think I started out a year ago rated about 900 and now I'm about 1200, which is a reasonably good improvement for a kind of a beginner, but there'll be many people listening to this who are, you know, rated 2000, and those are the people I, you know, will lose in a few moves to at a conference, as it were.
I see. Well, I was always very bad at chess, and as a result, I refused to ever play it, and then never got any better because I found being bad at it so excruciating. So I didn't even know the scale went up that high, but I imagine that 2000 is very, very far out of my league. So, well, I think in saying this, I'm already revealing something about my own fears and anxieties. So I'm going to use it as a transition to question five, which is another Murdoch-inspired question, beginning with a quote. "It's always a significant question to ask about any philosopher," she wrote. "What is he afraid of?" So what are you afraid of?
So one thing I'm afraid of is not living my life fully enough, I think. And that definitely extends to philosophy, although it's not limited to philosophy. So, I mean, I've just finished the semester and I've just finished teaching a pro seminar at Hopkins for the first and second year graduate students, something I absolutely love doing, partly because I get to do it with my wife, Hannah Pickard, who's a wonderful philosopher, partly because it's great to get to know the new graduate students just as they set off on their sort of philosophical journeys. But the way we do it is we read this really diverse range of different papers from the recent literature in, you know, this year in metaphysics, aesthetics, moral psychology, epistemology, Buddhist philosophy this year too. You know, whatever papers seem interesting to us and then the students. And almost every time after class, I feel completely full of that class's issues. And I have all these half-baked ideas I want to, you know, go away and write up and think more about, work out properly. And then I don't because some other obligation intervenes. So, you know, one fear in philosophy is just that I'm going to end up with this huge list of things I really wanted to explore but never found the time for. And I guess that thing would extend to life too, and more generally, you know, places I'd love to have been or lived or known and so on.
Well, I don't often cite myself, but this is one of the things I wrote about in midlife, where part of my observation was that, well, it's better than the alternative, which would be studying philosophy and finding really none of it very interesting, or most of it worthless or unable to captivate your attention. So this is the kind of frustration that is a side effect of something really wonderful about philosophy and about the world.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think, you know, I don't ever worry about a loss of problems, as it were. And the way that you can carry on as an academic, hopefully for many, many years doing that exploring, you don't need to retire if you don't want to, is a real joy. And so I'm glad about that.
Well, we'll end on that, the positive note that we're not going to run out of philosophical problems. And I'll say thank you, Ian, for appearing on the podcast.
Thanks so much, Kieran. It's been a pleasure.
Ian Phillips is Bloomberg Distinguished Professor of Philosophy and Brain Sciences at Johns Hopkins University. He's the author of Perceiving Temporal Properties, The Temporal Structure of Experience, and other essays. Thanks for listening to Five Questions.